Welcome back. WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive, our ongoing educational series here all week long. And big thanks to our sponsors at State Fair, of course, and downtown at Fadley's. And I would hope that our next guest, we will be joining him for a Fadley's crab cake at the new Lexington Market at some point, as well as our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty. Don, this was your vision on Education Week, and I know we wanted to get all the presidents, all the chancellors. We've had a chance to reach out to everyone, but especially important for our city universities, right?
Absolutely. It's Baltimore Positive, and we are delighted to welcome Dr. David Wilson, president of Morgan State University. Doc, you're coming up on your 10th year. Does it feel like 10 years?
Well, Don, you know, I can't believe that I've actually been here almost 10 years. It seems like only yesterday that my family and I were literally unloading our U-Haul as I drove from Wisconsin, believe it or not, drove my own U-Haul here to Baltimore, and it just does not seem like it's been 10 years, but it has, and each year has not been like the previous year, and it's been very, very exciting to be in our city and to have been given the privilege to lead just what is a remarkable university, you know, one of the most remarkable institutions that I have embraced in higher education in America.
Well, we're going to have you talk about that, but I can already hear Nestor. Nestor's first question he loves to ask when folks come from someplace else, you came from Wisconsin, what was it about Baltimore and Morgan State that made you say to your family, let's pack up the U-Haul, let's go? What was it?
Yeah, we were all born here, Doc. You know, that's why we're here, you know?
Well, let me just say that I really had gone to Wisconsin as a chancellor out there to stay about 25 years and then retire, and I still actually have a residence there in Madison as well. And so Morgan had a president who had been here for 25 years, served the university very well. The board was looking for the president's successor, and they were very deliberate and did a national search, and I assume they were not satisfied perhaps with the candidates that they were looking at, and so I got a telephone call from a member of the board here asking if I would consider having a conversation with them, and they wanted to fly out to Madison to meet with me, and I had never, of course, been to the Morgan campus. I knew about Morgan, but I had never been to the campus. And so initially I said to them, no. I said, I'm very happy. I'm very happy where I am.
I've been to State Street. That's nice. They got good cheese up there, right?
Well, yeah, I'd fallen in love with Wisconsin. It was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. But the board called me back and said, look, we would like for a member of the board to come out and have a conversation with you. It would be noncommittal. And I said, sure, why not? And she flew out, and we talked about it, and she said, well, look, why don't you just come to Baltimore and take a look at Morgan? And I said to her, yes, I would do that, but it would have to be on my own terms. I cannot come in any kind of formal way. I have to experience Baltimore City and experience Morgan in my own way. And they agreed. And so I flew out from Madison to Baltimore.
It's like one of those TV shows, like Undercover Cop, right?
Well, almost like that. It really was. You know, I got a little hotel room down in the Harbor East, and I remember it's a Friday afternoon, and I rented a car, and then I made my way to the campus. I had on jeans, and I had a baseball hat, and I turned it back, you know.
You were just a guy.
And so I really wanted to be incognito, and I came up and I walked to campus, and I stopped students indiscriminately and just asked them about the institution. And I was so impressed. I was so impressed with the brilliance of the students, the love and passion they had for Morgan, and the dedication and commitment on the part of the faculty that I met along the way. And I just stopped in the middle of the campus and took it all in and said, this place has so much potential. And mean, the rest is history.
Well, what about the city itself? You know, coming to Baltimore at this point, because the story you just gave, if I am the proud father, and I'm old enough now to be the proud father, you know, of a college student, and Don's a grandfather who's sending his daughter to Roanoke, and she's checking out schools. The first thing that you got recruited there, right? So, like, you came in from the outside, and the city and the school and the people recruited you. That's an easy sell to any parent, I think, in the aftermath of whatever we're about to discuss here with COVID, right? And what that is that this is a great place.
Oh, yes, as a matter of fact. I love Baltimore City. And I obviously love Morgan State University. But I had not really spent a whole lot of time in Baltimore City, even though I lived in Philadelphia for 16, 17 years. And I would get the train from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., who knows, 1,000 times, but never really got off the train to explore the city of Baltimore at all. And so I didn't know quite what to expect when I arrived in Harbor East on that Friday afternoon.
Well, 10 years later, here you are, right?
Oh, and that weekend, and I got in a car. I mean, you know, I just drove around the city, and I had done a little bit of research in terms of how historic the city was, and so I visited some of the historic places, and I just had to take it all in as a city that I had absolutely regrets that I had not had an opportunity or had not taken the opportunity to explore it more. And so as I have lived here now for almost 10 years, I think Baltimore is a very special city, and it has an illustrious history, and it has produced some of the best leaders I think we've seen in this country. And it has outstanding higher education institutions here. And so there's so much that is positive about Baltimore, and I'm just delighted, you know, to be a citizen.
Well, Doc, when you look back 10 years ago and you were having a discussion with the Board of Trustees at Morgan, at which point 10 years ago in that discussion did they ask you how you would handle a pandemic? Do you remember? which part of the interview was that?
Because we're going to have one of those, and you're going to have to be able to handle it.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, that was the first question, actually. You know? No. This is... in terms of the challenges that we are facing now resulting from the pandemic, this is something they don't teach you in school. The kind of crisis planning that typically takes place on a university campus is, you know, right now around things like active shooter training. And those kinds of things, but not in terms of how you deal with a pandemic. And it's certainly how you deal with a pandemic where the entire world has come to a standstill. This not only has been challenging for Morgan, it's been challenging for the 4,000-plus higher education institutions in the country.
Well, give us, I think what our listeners are really enjoying as we talk with the leaders of higher ed, give us a sense of the 48 hours after you heard we were going to be shut down, and as you said, everything's going to come to a halt. Give us a glimpse into the life of a college president in the 48 hours following that announcement.
Well, it's like being mayor of a city, you know, because you have to think about everything. And so in our case, our students were leaving the university for spring break. I think we were just seeing evidence of the fact that the virus was spreading rapidly. And the only thing we said to the students, you know, were, look, take all of the essential items, any medications you're taking or computers or things of that sort. But we did. We did not say to them, and don't expect to return. And so while they were on spring break, that was the first executive order that we saw coming from the governor, which was to discourage individuals who were away on spring break from returning directly to the campus, but to take at least 14 days in self-quarantine. And so we did that, and then we followed immediately by placing our courses online during that two-week quarantine period. But then, right before the end of spring break, the spread of the pandemic, or the virus, I should say, became worse. And so then we had to make the decision to not have students come back to the campus at all. And that was a real tough decision, because we have many students here at Morgan, who unfortunately don't have any other place to go. We have international students. We have students who have home security issues, meaning that they don't really have homes that they can easily kind of pack up their clothes and go back to. And so to tell them not only could they not come back to the campus, but those who have stayed on the campus must vacate the campus was tough.
Well, that's an angle, quite honestly, that we haven't approached. Dr. Wilson, talk to us a little bit about what happened with those students and how did you help them decide what to do next?
Yeah, and so, I started having sometimes two-a-day meetings with my cabinet, and as president, I had to kind of put on the table some guiding principles, and, those guiding principles was that, we really had to approach whatever we were doing with compassion, that we had to understand our responsibility as leaders in exercising what I call the duty of care.
Well, you are their home, right? Literally, they consider your dorm room, that's where they live, right?
That's where they live. And so every decision that we made here at Morgan was really about how do we say to our students, look, we care about you, but we're in a position where we have to do these things, but we're going to work with you. To make sure that it is not going to be unbearably disruptive. And so, therefore, we allow the students to keep their things in the residential halls. And so 90% of the student belongings are still in the residential halls, and we're working with them up until May 15th, when hopefully some of the states will have relaxed restrictions on travel to get back to Morgan and get those things out of the residential halls. We then work with students individually who could not go back home, and we moved all of them into one residential hall here. We got about 160 students. And then we have to provide food service for them and security. And so we have to make all those decisions, if you will, in relatively short order.
We've heard so much about kids going home of all ages, and Don's daughter is a high school or elementary school principal, and we've talked to Dr. Santa Lise here in the city as well as Dr. Williams out in the county. Just kids go home, they don't have Wi-Fi, right? We just think that we have it, so everyone has it, especially when you don't live in an urban area. And I know I'm talking to someone that grew up in an area that was far, far, far from an urban area where everyone would just have Wi-Fi. Housing is something we have not heard a whole bunch of from other chancellors and presidents, but the one universal thing is learning from home, if you have a home, may or may not include the type of Wi-Fi that you would need in order to be educated. We've talked so much about, I know when we contacted you earlier, you were on a Zoom, and we've been on Zooms together, and this is how we're communicating, but if you don't have access to that, you're really being cut off from education of any kind, let alone higher education.
Yeah, I can speak about that, very directly, because what I opted to do about a month or so ago was to audit two of the online courses here at Morgan, because I wanted to get a sense, for the context in which that instruction was being delivered and how it was received. And so I ended up auditing a course in music, in musical theory, and also a course in political science on research methods. And what you just said was an eye-opener for me in terms of the number of our students who also did not have laptops, the number of students where the Wi-Fi was non-existent or it was so uneven that it just absolutely disrupted what was attempting to take place in terms of the learning process. And then I think what I took away from that most of all was that in many instances, the students, when you send them home, they don't have these kind of dedicated spaces where they can go and shut the door, and it's a kind of a quiet space conducive for learning. Some of our students, when they go home, they are meeting a reality where if they are online in a class, their little brother is coming into the class, their little sister is coming into the class, you know, the cat and the dog.
Kind of like me when I bother my wife and she's trying to engineer in the other room a little bit, right?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. but you have to take that into account as you are delivering remote instruction, that this is not, in many instances, this kind of ideal environment, and then how does a professor try and be flexible enough to understand that?
Doc, are you caught, and I know I'm not going to ask you to go out on a limb and make a prediction, but are you cautiously optimistic that students will be able to return for a semi-normal fall semester?
Well, things will be very, very different until a vaccine is discovered for the COVID-19 virus. And so
that's a hard thing for a lot of people to accept, isn't it? I mean, you've just said something that's a sentence, and I agree with it. You know, on various days, Don thinks we were going to play baseball later this summer. You know, I don't. We all want to believe, but there is the cold reality of why we put masks on to begin with, right? And I think it's very hard. That's been a very, very hard thing to just accept what you just said, for everyone to accept that.
Well, sure, and it's very hard for universities to accept it. I mean, you can see that some of my colleagues have already gone forward and have said, yeah, we're opening up in the fall, and it's going to be no different than the way it was in January. Now, you know, we at Morgan, you know, may very well go down the path where we will be open as a university, but it will be with certain restrictions in place, which is what we're planning for. And so if social distancing is still in place, there are restrictions around the number of people that can gather in a group, then we are taking that into our planning model. What does that mean when you have a residential hall right now that can accommodate 800 students? But, you know, if you have to engage in social distancing in the way in which you populate that residential hall, you may only be able to house 350 students. What does it mean when you have classrooms that are equipped for 100 students if, for example, you can only have up to 20 students in that classroom? Well, that means that you have to have five sections of that class, which means that you need to hire more instructors to teach five sections. And so we're modeling all of that. And so this is a real financial burden, if you will, on institutions, because we don't have those kind of resources where now we have to go out and hire 30% more faculty to teach courses that are limited in capacity.
Don, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so you know, what I'm saying is that we certainly are preparing for some degree of openness in the fall, which I think perhaps 80% of colleges will do, but we are also baking into that preparation social distancing and other restrictions that may still be in place.
Don, how long am I going to hold the doctor next time we get together and talk about the School of Global Journalism and Communication, and how long are we going to get together and we talk about McKinley, Alabama? And by the way, Tuskegee, there's a famous Raven player named Anthony Mitchell who went to Tuskegee. So I want to, like, next time we get together, and I know your time is short today, because Don and I would sit here for hours and go back and forth with you, because we love having folks like you on.
Absolutely. And I do want to ask just real quickly, Nestor, and I appreciate the doc's time as well, but I can't have the president of Morgan State University on without talking about the importance of historically black colleges and universities. We had Speaker of the House Adrian Jones on, a big supporter of historically black colleges and universities. Just tell our listeners why support and the whole equity issue and fairness issues related to historically black colleges matter, and why they're important to the education fabric of the United States.
This gives you a chance to plug Tuskegee, too, because Anthony always did.
We don't have to always start, though, by saying that institutions like Morgan are historically black, but that does not define who we serve. Just as the University of Maryland College Park is historically white, but that does not describe who it serves. And so 70% of our students here are African American, but 30% are not. And so you have institutions that are historically white who may have 70% of their students that are white and 20% that are not, and those institutions are considered to be extremely diverse, but so is Morgan. So I have to put that out there for the audience to understand that we
That's
have students
important.
Here. Absolutely. We have students here from over 60 countries. We have white students, Hispanic students, Asian students. And so Morgan and HBCUs like Morgan, and this is basically from a person who has studied the history of American higher education, we are the only set of institutions that have never discriminated against anyone from day one, have been open from day one to individuals of all races. And so today, we are historically black, which is a descriptor. Even so, you take an institution like Morgan just in the state of Maryland. Let's take engineering. We are number one in the state of Maryland in producing black electrical engineers. We're number one in civil engineering. We're number one in industrial engineering. We are number one in the United States of America in producing black electrical engineers. Number one in the U.S. in producing black civil. Number two in industrial. We're number four in the U.S. in producing black engineers in all fields. When it comes to chemistry and biology and the sciences, same thing. We're number two in the nation in producing black architects. And I can go down the list, if you will. And so what Morgan is saying is that we serve students of all races, of all ethnicities, from every aspect of the globe. And you come here, you're going to get a world-class education. We're going to basically challenge you. We're going to challenge you to grow as a person, to grow as a leader, to grow in perspective, because the world is not one color. And when you get out there, as a result of having the kind of experience you have in Morgan, we say to our graduates, you are prepared to dance on the world stage with anyone, anywhere, any place, anytime. And that's what the value of Morgan and an HBCU experience is designed to do.
Well, Nestor, that's a mic drop there, I think.
That's it. Take it there. We're done. I've learned all I can learn here today, Dr. Wilson. We really appreciate your time. We definitely will invite you back, hopefully for Faithley's Crab Cake downtown. I must say that I was at the Mayoral Forum back in January on your campus. Always lovely. Been to Hill many times. I wasn't there for the legendary LeBron night, but but it did come to me, and we did broadcast. So I appreciate you very much and making time for us today.
Thank you very much for asking me to appear.
Dr. David Wilson, he is the 10th president of Morgan State University, you can find all there is at morgan.edu and all that they're doing there. We're having an educational week here. We're going through campus to campus. We've had Dr. Freeman Rabowski on. We've had Jay Perman on. We've had Dr. Kim Schatzel on. So we're going around. Kurt Schmoke, the Honorable. He said, I don't have to call him Mr. Mayor anymore. He said, oh, we stopped all that. I said, all right, fair enough. At my alma mater of UB. So we've also had community colleges. So all of this going on, we're going to get to Coppin in a few weeks. They have a new incoming president, so we're going to talk to both outgoing and incoming at Coppin, because I know Dr. Wilson would be upset that I have my Coppin banner behind me. But I did wear some Morgan colors. So, but Coppin is our partner at WNST, so I should say that we do broadcast the Coppin Morgan games, and we've attended a few and swabbed a few because we're Baltimore positive like that. Nasty at WNST.net finds me. Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Snapchat, 200 episodes plus now with Don Mohler, former Baltimore County executive and my partner here for all of this, education, arts. Next week, the mayoral candidates. Big shout-out to our friends at State Fair. Keep the shrimp and grits ready for me over there, Evan, as well as that great Mexican food across the street, as well as Faithley's downtown. And, of course, Mohler and Gary Realty and Jeff Mohler, who we featured last month in the buyatoyota.com audio vault. And he spent more time with me than he has his dad last month because of social distancing. So here we are. So Jeff didn't social distance from me. He joined me on the phone. And his kids were running around just like what Dr. Wilson had to say. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, and Baltimore Positive, always keeping it local.